name is Doug Thorpe, and this is the third session on Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And we are putting this novel into the context of 1962 when it was published. We're hitting today the middle of the novel. And I have put on the board some more dates and information just to continue to give us some context of 1962. And it will be your task to figure out how all these are connected, other than the fact they're all going on in pretty much the same year. In fact, these are all in the same year. I've got one to add. It's 1963. Okay, so once again, Kesey himself was born in 1938, meaning that he's 24 when this novel comes out. 1962, publication of the novel. 1962, Sex and the Single Girl was published. Anybody know who wrote that book?
Dylan
Brown, who just recently died, right? And so that's what alerted me to the fact that that book came out in 1962. And what else is Helen Burley Brown best known for?
Cosmopolitan.
She took Cosmopolitan magazine, which was a very, I would say, run-of-the-mill, very traditional woman's magazine, and transformed it into what we now know as Cosmopolitan magazine and the Cosmo Girl. And Sex and the Single Girl was her kind of breakthrough work. Anybody read it or familiar with the content? Do you remember? Of course. So what do you remember?
Oh. Just
give us the gist. Specifically?
The idea of sex outside of marriage.
Yes.
Multiple sexual partners.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And celebrating that.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
absolutely. Affirming
that
in fact single women, first of all, affirming that women like to have sex.
Mm-hmm.
Second, affirming that single women are having sex and are enjoying having sex, and that that's a good thing and perfectly appropriate. So it was, I mean, it was a fairly startling concept at the time. And then Cosmopolitan, in some ways, takes that and develops it. Okay. The following year, what I didn't put up there is 1963, is Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique. And anybody give us a synopsis of the Feminine Mystique? I did a little research. Let's see if I can quickly locate that. Widely credited sparking the beginning of second wave feminism in the United States. In 1957, Friedan was asked to conduct a survey of her former Smith College classmates for their 15th anniversary reunion. The results, in which she found that many of them were unhappy with their lives as housewives, prompted her to begin research with the Feminine Mystique, conducting interviews with other suburban housewives, as well as researching psychology, media, and advertising. She originally intended to publish an article on the topic, not a book, but no magazine would publish the article. So it begins with an introduction describing what Friedan called the problem that has no name, the widespread unhappiness of women in the 1950s and early 1960s. Discuss the lives of several housewives from around the United States who are unhappy despite living in material comfort and being happily married with fine children, and so on. So that's 1963. So there's that. 1962, the U.S. military for the first time employs Agent Orange in Vietnam. And what does Agent Orange do? Anybody remember
defoliant.
That?
Defoliant.
It's a defoliant, okay. Clears out jungle, clears out brush, makes roads, bridges, etc., visible. As we now know, of course, highly toxic. 1962, I'm going to skip down, James Meredith enrolls at Ole Miss, and briefly for those who may not be familiar with James Meredith and the historical importance of that, anybody remember?
The governor stood in the door.
Yes, yeah.
First African American.
Yeah, first African American to enroll at the University of Mississippi after a tremendous battle and waged in part by the governor, who was handily reelected in part because of his opposition.
But didn't Robert have to go down there and intervene?
Yes, oh yeah, yes. Now, there were major interventions to actually make that happen. And in 1962, August, Marilyn Monroe dies. And interesting, I've been referencing, those of you who've been here, I've been referencing James Taylor Branch's Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954 to 1963. And this, we get a paragraph, actually three paragraphs, on the death of Marilyn Monroe. Interesting, in this book about America in the King Years. Marilyn Monroe died on the night of August 4th in her bedroom across the country. He has been focusing on what Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy are doing, and right now, the day Marilyn Monroe dies, they are in jail in Albany, Georgia. They're back in jail because they were released surreptitiously. Albany mayor and his Confederates secretly paid the fine to get Martin Luther King out of jail because it was such an embarrassment to have him in jail, and he refused to pay the fine himself. So they claimed that an unknown African American had secretly, you know, paid the fine and so on, whereas in fact it was the sheriff and the mayor and so on paid the fine. And King, you know, was outraged because, you know, he was making a point and so found a way to get back into jail ultimately. So all that's going on and as an unresolved issue. And so Robert Kennedy and JFK are trying to deal with the turmoil around Martin Luther King. Meanwhile, across the country, Marilyn Monroe dies. Attorney General Kennedy attended Mass the next morning at the Church of St. Mary in Gilroy, California. We know Robert Kennedy was in California, and it's now there's a lot of evidence that Robert Kennedy was actually at Marilyn Monroe's house the day that she died. Outside San Francisco, already there are reports of mysterious phone calls, gaps in Monroe's last hours, subsequent decades lent more credence to the Hollywood gossip. Following later disclosures about President Kennedy's associations with Frank Sinatra's friends, and this we talked about yesterday, all this interconnection between the mafia, a girlfriend of the mafia, who's also JFK's girlfriend, Frank Sinatra, introducing JFK to this woman, also introducing JFK to Marilyn Monroe, and it's absolutely clear JFK and Marilyn Monroe had a long-standing affair that had recently come to an end, and that Marilyn Monroe had threatened to have a press conference telling everybody about her relationship with JFK. That's public knowledge. And of course, J. Edgar Hoover following all of this soap opera via his bugs. He's gathering data. Kennedy left San Francisco after Mass for the World's Fair in Seattle. At a press conference there, reporters asked him about a scathing think tank report that accused J. Edgar Hoover of using sententious poppycock to exaggerate the threat of the tiny U.S. Communist Party. Because this is what Hoover is primarily interested in, is trying to get rid of communism. Although the report accurately expressed Kennedy's own private views, he parried the question in defense of Hoover. The reason the Communist Party was so small, he replied, was precisely that Hoover had been so skillful in controlling it. Quote, I hope he will serve the country for many, many years to come. And then you get this really interesting paragraph. At the White House, a stunned Arthur Schlesinger, who was, I think, secretary for JFK, wrote in his journal of his vivid memories of Marilyn Monroe from the Kennedy birthday party in May. Marilyn Monroe had flown from Hollywood to sing, I think it was maybe Carnegie Hall, or it was maybe in D.C., to sing Happy Birthday to JFK at this big celebration for his birthday. And she showed up in this really outrageous, skin-tight, practically see-through gown and sings happy birthday to him. And there's a party afterwards. And Marilyn is there, and Robert Kennedy is there, and so on.
And Jackie. And her singing was incredibly sultry.
Oh, it's done all the time. Happy birthday, Mr.
Yeah. My understanding is that Jackie didn't show up at the party afterwards, in part because...
But she was there for the
She was at the singing. She was at the singing. So this is what Schlesinger... He wrote in his journal after the death of Mary Monroe. I do not think I've seen anyone so beautiful. I was enchanted by her manner and her wit, at once so masked, so ingenuous, and so penetrating. But one felt a terrible unreality about her, as if talking to someone underwater. Bobby and I engaged in mock competition for her. She was most agreeable to him and pleasant to me, but then she receded into her own glittering mist. It's a beautiful statement, really. Then she receded into her own glittering mist. So, Marilyn Monroe, who of course was not born Marilyn Monroe, she's Norma Jean. And what Marilyn Monroe did was, I mean, what Norma Jean did was to create Marilyn Monroe. And I'll give you a very brief statement about that, and then we'll try to see how all this fits together and ties into One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Let's see. Let's see. This is from a biography of Marilyn Monroe that came out actually just this year by a feminist historian. So it's an extraordinary biography, really, really detailed, thoughtful, analytical exploration of the significance of Marilyn Monroe. She had freckles on her skin, hair on the sides of her face, she concealed with makeup. She had dark hair on her arms, which she concealed with body makeup. The 1950s, this is, I'm quoting the biography, women wore heavy makeup, a result of the return to femininity after World War II and the power of advertising to create a demand for cosmetics. Marilyn led the trend. To make her lips larger and more lustrous, she applied four layers of lipstick, drew her lip line outside its natural shape. She put Vaseline on her lips to make them look wet. It could take as long as 3 hours to get her makeup right. Finding a flaw, she might take off the makeup and start over. She was a perfectionist in terms of getting this image exactly right. She also, of course, had a deeply troubled childhood, never knew who her father was. She had ideas about who her father was, and her mother was institutionalized. Put her up not for adoption, in foster homes, and so she was raised that way. Often was attracted to older men, married older men, obviously Joe DiMaggio, Arthur Miller, and herself was a stutterer in her childhood and adolescence, and actually still had that problem while she was making movies, and was hospitalized herself at one point. During her time with her psychiatrist, Ralph Greenson, she had a recurring dream in which she was running through a cemetery in the early dawn, frantically looking for a way to escape. She graphically described the tall headstones and the feel of the dewy grass on her feet, but she never got out of the cemetery. On one occasion, when the psychiatrist was trying to persuade her to give up drugs, and she was heavily addicted to sedatives that would help her to sleep, and then amphetamines that would help her morning and to perform and so on and so forth. And she was not, of course, alone in having that problem in Hollywood. Trying to persuade her to give up drugs, the psychiatrist told her it was either Mr. Nembutal or me. And Nembutal is a sedative, I think a very strong sedative. She replied to him that the drugs made her feel woomy and toomy. Woomy and toomy. when she was in the hospital, and there's an interesting connection here, this is our transition, perhaps, to Cuckoo's Nest, and we're already in there, aren't we? She's in the mental hospital. Quote, remembering her neurotic behavior in a film called Don't Bother to Knock, she smashed the window on the bathroom door and threatened to cut her wrist with a shard of glass. The Furies, she wrote, came and went. So she felt imprisoned in this mental hospital. In fact, it was a really, really terrible place where they were strapping her down, and it was a horrible situation. And in order to get some attention, she literally smashed the bathroom door and cut herself. The Furies, she wrote, came and went. Anybody familiar with your Greek tragedy? Who are the Furies? They're goddesses associated with the underworld. And in the Oresteia, in Aeschylus's Oresteia, they are the ones who come to defend Clytemnestra after her son Orestes had killed her. Of course, Clytemnestra had killed her husband, Agamemnon. It's wonderful, this amazing story. Right? And the Furies are there to defend the mother. Right? Okay, so the Furies came and went. There is, and one of the things the biography points out, that there was this underlying rage that was there in Marilyn Monroe, just underlying rage, that she was able to channel. I think, I want to say 59, 60, somewhere around there. Yeah. Yeah. So how do we make this connection to Cuckoo's Nest? We got Agent Orange. We got the Vietnam War starting to heat up. America, of course, a few years earlier had taken over for the French. Viet Cong is formed, 1959. U.S. servicemen killed in guerrilla attack. The first American to die in the Vietnam War, 1959. How's all this connect? I don't know either, so.
The idyllic era of the 50s was done?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah, you know, and I'd say, please.
The so-called.
The underground.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
People are starting to express.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that Leave It to Beaver world, Father Knows Best, this image.
I think of it as an eruption of the culture.
Yes.
I think it was informational age, too, because television was now becoming in every household. You know, in the 50s, only very elite had access to that. But now,
yes.
The news is right there in Vietnam. The news is bringing live photos of Meredith on the doorstep and George Wallace standing there saying no.
Yeah.
We were seeing things that we'd never seen before.
Yeah,
so the information age was coming of age also.
Yeah, that's very true. And that's part of the explosion.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of like to ask, you know, people that remember that year, and all that stuff, how that impacted that age.
Yes.
What was happening to us? You know, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
What was happening?
Yeah.
I remember specifically the night that, you know, Kent. But that was a year later.
Yes.
You know, where I was, what I was doing, you know, the day that Bobby was shot, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Specific timetables of what part of your life you were in.
Yes.
I was about 15 or 16.
Yes. Yeah, please.
I remember transferring from a small liberal arts college in central New York State to Buffalo up on Lake Erie.
This is 1962.
I was a transferred junior student, so I was assigned a roommate who was a black girl. And my experience with black people were that on my father's farm, there were these migrant workers who came through every summer, and they that's all the people I knew. There were no black people in town. In fact, everybody in that whole county called them jigaboos. So my family couldn't stand it that I was living with a jigaboo. Well, this girl was from a very wealthy family on Long Island. Her father was a physician, and she was very smart. She graduated that year as a Phi Beta Kappa. She applied for, well, I have to say that I transformed very quickly into thinking of her as just a regular girl. At first, I was sort of embarrassed to walk across campus with her because, of course, everybody was looking at us. Well, one time we were going over to play tennis, and she said, I hope the courts aren't full, Judy. And I said, that's okay, we'll sit down and get a suntan. And she looks at me and she says, yeah, I really need that, Judy. She has dark skin. So I got over that quickly because she was just an ordinary, very nice girl. Well, when she applied to medical school, she applied to every medical school in New York State. She had to put a little picture like this up in the right-hand corner of the application. She got accepted to none of them except Buffalo, where she was a Phi Beta Kappa. And that was my first experience. I mean, we had seen the stuff on the television and the news about what was happening in the South, but that was the South. We were different. We weren't different.
Yes.
It was a major shock to me, and really impacting my whole life.
I'm sure. Yeah, and what you were saying to me earlier is that for her, I mean, here was a young woman that was full of confidence, incredibly talented, incredibly gifted.
And right, and her personality changed. I mean, she just sort of shrunk down into herself. She lost her confidence, and she ended up being the first woman physician to graduate from the University of Buffalo.
Yeah.
And is still practicing on Long Island.
So,
I had shared with Doug earlier that 62 was my first. I've been raised in Minnesota and Washington State, and so 62 was my first year to go into the South. And I was working for the Lutheran Church in a youth program, and it was my first exposure to segregation and the reality of it. But that was disturbing enough, but what was even more disturbing were the actions of the local churches and the attitudes of the people with whom I was working, including the clergy. And so I returned from that summer. It was the beginning of my skepticism about the institutional church, and frankly, as Vietnam then continued, my skepticism about all institutions. So it was a formative time in that way.
Yeah. So I'm very struck by, and sort of going back to this notion of, you know, the words we're using, explosion. We were talking about revolution yesterday. That there was this, there was a veneer, there was a kind of surface sense of what America was, what a woman was, what a man was, what your roles were. And we tend to think of the 1950s and pre-1963 as the height of that, again, post-World War II, creation of the suburbs, creation of the superhighways, all that stuff. And I mean, that's my story in a way. I was born in 1953, and my father was a Depression-era kid, World War II vet. I was saying to a few people, I think, after class yesterday, Battle of the Bulge, front lines at the end of World War II, and just hugely impacted by that. I mean, it was, my father developed dementia in the last few years of his life. Really, the only thing he remembered were the stories from the war. That was what was still with him. And there's ways in which he never healed from the trauma of that war. And for him, I mean, he also said that he vowed once he got back from the war that he would never spend another night out in a tent, and he almost succeeded at that. My brother was a Boy Scout and got him out once or twice. And he said that you know, he had moved around a lot as a kid because his parents, it was depression, alcoholic mother, family in trouble, they moved all the time. He said, you know, I'm going to buy a house, we're going to move to the suburbs, we're going to stay put, and he succeeded. he completely succeeded in many, many ways. But, so there was this veneer in a way. But on the other hand, I was raised in Oak Park, Illinois, which is on the western, just the western edge of Chicago. And this is also the time of the civil rights movement. My father was the village attorney. And really, the thing that was the center of his work was trying to open up Oak Park to integration, rather than have it turn into White Flight, turn into Skokie, turn into Melrose Park, and so on and so forth. And so as village attorney, he was trying to set things up so that that didn't happen. And you know, there are a lot of stories about, one example, a bunch of black guys showed up at my house late one night, knocked on the door. My dad lets them in. Turns out that one of the local real estate agents, they'd gone to the real estate agent, they were looking for housing. The real estate agent said, sorry, all these houses, these have been sold, right? They, of course, found out subsequently later on that day that that was a lie. They go to my dad, really angry, you know, what's going on here? And the fact is that that particular real estate agent was one of my dad's best friends. His son was my best friend at the time. And so the next day, my dad had the pleasant task of going to Emerson Hauser and saying, Emerson, you know, I love you, guy, but if you don't, if you don't stop that practice, I'm going to have your ass in jail, basically. So, I mean, that was the context as well. Right? And this was the North. And again, in the, there's even more of a veneer in the North. Oh, we're not the South. Right? But of course, I mean, it was very strongly present in the North as well. The day Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968, we were traveling with the Housers, with other family friends on a vacation in the South, actually. And I wasn't in the room, but my folks were with their family friends when the news came on the television about the shooting of Martin Luther King. These are suburban, college-educated, northern folks, good people. They were our family friends. When the news came on that he'd been shot, everybody applauded in the room. Everybody applauded, except for my folks. Everybody applauded. It's important. That's an important story. It's really important to remember. Really important to remember. I mean, Martin Luther King was really vilified. Right? And this ties into the novel. You go back to the beginning of the novel, and those black workers who are under the big nurse, the words that we're getting over and over again associated with them is hatred. They are filled with hatred, filled with rage. And the only place they have to take that out on is Chief Brompton. So there's this underlying tension that's going on. Okay? And Chief Brompton keeps talking about the combine. And big nurse, in a sense, works for the combine. And the combine is this metaphor for some kind of power that really is in control of everything and that is running machinery, running wires, and has everybody under its control. Okay, so why combine? What does combine suggest?
You know what it struck me as is I remember writing a paper back then on the military-industrial complex.
Yes.
One of the first times that had ever come into fruition.
Yes.
And the more you learned about it,
right,
the more combined-ish it became. Yes. It was the very beginning of, this thought process that there's a lot more to it than what we see.
Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting because the word, I think, is playing on a couple of things. One, as a noun, we associate combine with a harvesting machine. Okay. It's threshing grain. And so you have that metaphor of, you know, of taking grain, working it. There's a certain kind of violence in it. I mean, that whole process of taking the grain and, you know, working with it. But also, of course, in the word combine is combination, things combining, things coming together. And we think of that in pretty positive terms normally, the way things are interrelated. This is good ecological thinking, right? But in this context, you know, your association with the military-industrial complex makes a lot of sense.
Because we were coming out of the Eisenhower-Nixon era.
Exactly.
And, wow, we just kicked butt over there. Now what are we doing?
Right.
You know, he was the guy.
Yes.
He and Churchill were the guy.
Yes.
And now we're kind of evolving to a different part of the world.
Yes.
You know, and it was a little after Korea and a little after, you know, some of our skirmishes around bad places.
Yeah, something had worked in World War II, right? I mean, in some ways that's the height of American power in a positive way, right? But by this point, you know, something else is happening, and this development in the Vietnam War, and again, I think of Agent Orange as a kind of metaphor for this, this defoliation. I mean, using this toxic chemical to expose, to try to locate, to, again, to gain a kind of power and control. So here you have the Combine, and the mental hospital, of course, is a microcosm of that Combine, where everybody is under the control of this. And Big Nurse is this odd, paradoxical figure, big-breasted, and so marked with her femininity, but trying strongly with a starched uniform to conceal, to hide, to deny that femininity. So the femininity, I mean, is completely denied here, right? And into this context, you have McMurphy come. And McMurphy is this kind of Western hero, right? And so I'm going to give you a paragraph early in the novel, and we're going to move to the passage that I've got here today. But this is the introduction of McMurphy, back on page 23. Again, narrator is Chief Bromden, who is apparently deaf and dumb, although we find out that he's not. I remember real clear the way that hand looked as McMurphy comes over to shake hands with Chief Bromden. There was carbon under the fingernails where he'd worked once in a garage. There was an anchor tattooed back from the knuckles. There was a dirty Band-Aid on the middle knuckle peeling up at the edge. All the rest of the knuckles were covered with scars and cuts, old and new. I remember the palm was smooth and hard as bone from hefting the wooden handles of axes and hoes, not the hand you'd think could deal cards because he's also a gambler. The palm was calloused, and the calluses were cracked, and dirt was worked in the cracks, a road map of his travels up and down the West. That palm made a scuffing sound against my hand. I remember the fingers were thick and strong, closing over mine, and my hand commenced to feel peculiar and went to swelling up out there on my stick of an arm, like he was transmitting his own blood into it. It rang with blood and power. It blowed up near as big as his, I remember. So there's this transmission of power. This is the beginning of the awakening of Chief Bromden, who thinks of himself as tiny, as vulnerable, as helpless and hopeless. And he feels the hand of McMurphy. Right? And of course, all that description, that's classic American male stuff. That's McMurphy. And I'm not saying yay or nay to that, because what also, I mean, there's an element of violence to it. I mean, McMurphy has slept his way around the country. His relationships with women are primarily prostitutes, right? And we saw in the passage yesterday that the kind of freedom that McMurphy represents is the freedom that comes by not having any responsibilities and any commitments to anybody. That is, it's McMurphy first. Everybody else is second. And so there's this tension in that character. And this is my experience as I was rereading the novel to teach it. Because my first experience with this novel was when I read it, I was 15 years old. And I have a vivid memory of the power, the impact of this novel when I was a 15-year-old boy. And the sense of the energy and the masculinity of McMurphy. The kind of freedom that he represented. And that's clearly there in Kesey's representation. But there's also this whole other dimension. that at 15 years, I didn't, 15 years old, I didn't really recognize that, as I didn't recognize just how misogynistic and how sexist it also is. So there is this curious dynamic. The passage that I passed out today, hope everybody got one, picks up on page 138.
Here's some.
There's a couple more here.
Several.
Thank you.
When was the catch on the writer?
50s. I want to say 55, around that. Franny and Zoe came out in, I think, 61, maybe. So this was right at the end of Salinger's writing career. But that's, again, in terms of touchstone, certainly Franny and Zoe right around this same time. So let's see. I will pick up on a page you don't have, the bottom 137, and you'll see me picking up on 138 where the Xerox comes in. The way Big Nurse acted so confident in that staff meeting, and what we're getting, of course, is a confrontation between Big Nurse and McMurphy. And it is moving towards, you know, a series of showdowns. And that language is Western movie kind of language. And that's very much the way it's being presented. She acted confident in staff meeting, worried me, but it didn't make any difference to McMurphy all weekend. He was just as hard on her and her black boys as he ever was. The patients were loving it. He'd won his bet. He'd gotten the nurse's goat the way he said he would and collected on it. But that didn't stop him from going right ahead and acting like he always had, hollering up and down the hall, laughing at the black boys, frustrating the whole staff, even going so far as to step up to the big nurse in the hall one time, and now I'm on 138, and ask her if she didn't mind telling just what the actual size was, what was the actual inch-by-inch measurement on them great big old breasts that she did her best to conceal but never could. She walked right on past, ignoring him, just like she chose to ignore the way nature had tagged her with those outsized badges of femininity, just like she was above him and sex and everything else that's weak and under flash. So that's one of the passages where we get some sense of what the way Kesey wants us to associate those breasts. Femininity, nature, and it's obvious that they're it's sexual, it's also maternal, and that's what is being denied here. If you turn over to the next page, 139, the bottom of that page, if someone would just start reading that paragraph, there was times that week when I'd heard that full-throttled laugh.
There was times that week when I'd hear that full-throttled laugh, watch him scratching his belly and stretching and yawning and leaning back to wink at whoever he was joking with, everything coming to him just as natural as drawing breath, and I'd quit worrying about the big nurse and the combine behind her. I'd think he was strong enough, being his own self, that he would never back down the way she was hoping he would. I'd think maybe he truly is something extraordinary. He's what he is, that's it. Maybe that makes him strong enough, being what he is. The combine hasn't got to him in all these years. What makes that nurse think she's going to be able to do it in a few weeks? He's not going to let them twist him and manufacture him.
And that was the passage. I'm sure that as a 15-year-old, it was one of the passages that really struck me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, he is what he is. That's it. Yeah.
A rugged American. He's out there. He's
out. Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah. But and it's like, and I'm trying to get at my own experience of this, because there's a way in which the way you put it. Is a critique in some ways of that. I mean, there's a stereotype. It is the John Wayne stereotype,
right,
in some ways. And you know, I have this love-hate relationship with John Wayne as an actor. my father was a huge John Wayne fan, and my father died 3 years ago, and so it's one of those connections that I have with him. My brother, who was 3 years older than I, who also died 3 years ago, huge John Wayne fan. Okay, so there's something about, there's an element of John Wayne that I want to claim. There's an element of a kind of integrity, a kind of honesty, a kind of strength that I want to actually claim in all of this, even while separating it from some of these other elements. And so there is something about this being what he is and not letting anybody manufacture him. You know, it's that word natural is part of it, right? Everything coming to him.
Sure, yeah, he's a 50s man. He's a man of the 50s.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Everything coming to him just as natural as drawing breath. So there's that quality. Yeah.
So how does all of this fit in the context of the fact that, you know, he's a big man, and,
yes,
you know, you can hear the,
yeah,
all this stuff, but he's in a mental institution, so it's,
yeah,
it's him, it's all him, and yet, you know, so is it, is this about not being able to be that real person out in the real world, or is,
right,
it more about, you know, it's like, well, that's a lot of hot air because you're,
right,
doing it in this very cocoon,
yeah,
place.
Well, the implication is that he was also that outside. It's important to remember that he's in the mental institute. It was part of, as a, he's a kind of trickster figure as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in prison on a work farm and, you know, sort of feigned craziness in order to, you know, get out of the work farm. So there's that element to it.
He's there
but
by choice.
He's there, in a sense, he's there by choice. He's there by choice, yeah. But,
well, when you look at it, I mean, he is basically the one that's real, the one that's sane, the one that's together there, and the rest of them are the crazies.
Except,
right,
that he's,
yeah,
not doing it in the real world. I mean, he might be a big man,
yeah,
on campus in a mental,
mm-hmm,
institution,
yes,
but,
yes,
what is he in the rest of society?
Right, yeah, yeah. And it's, yeah, I mean, and it depends on how you view the way he was living, right? I mean, the chief and those in the hospital look upon his life and his lifestyle as something wonderful and heroic, very romantic, very romantic. The way, you know, that paragraph as the chief is shaking his hands and the way his hands are scarred and so on and so forth, that is a romanticized notion, again, of the American male as free living and so on, right? And I'm not saying I buy that, all right? I'm entirely in agreement with you. What's striking, and how much Kesey himself is clear about, I actually think that Kesey himself buys into that to an extent, and that there's a problem there, yeah.
You're kind of brought into it, and,
yeah,
then you kind of forget.
Yes.
I mean, that's what's,
yeah,
fun about it.
In,
yeah,
that concept, he's the free man, he was the trickster because he was in prison.
Yes.
And this is his,
right,
freedom from prison, it's like he,
right,
wasn't free.
And why was he in prison? I mean, because he got into fights?
Yeah, because he was a rebel. He was all these things that we just talked about.
Right, yeah.
You know, he was standing there with Martin Luther King. He was standing right next to James Meredith in his mind.
See,
by,
that's, yeah,
by getting into a scuffle with somebody that asked a question like you just did.
Yeah.
You know,
it was
a sense of freedom.
Really?
Right. Even though he ended up in a place where he couldn't figure it out.
He was one of the characters on Kesey's bus.
Exactly.
Yes.
I mean, really.
Yes, yeah. You know, and really, there is, it's an adolescent energy. I mean, that's my sense of it. And that's why also, in terms of context, right, I mean, we've got Martin Luther King and Ralph Abernathy in jail, their life being threatened, their homes being bombed. And we've got hundreds, thousands of people unnamed, unknown, you know, going from the north. We've got itinerant black workers in rural Mississippi who are risking their lives to go down to the courthouse to register to vote. Right? You want to talk about heroism, right? right? I mean, there you've got heroism. And so, I'm trying to juxtapose that a little bit.
Well, and for yourself, you're 15, you know, he's right. 24, testosterone's kicking in.
Yes.
You know, the world has changed really rapidly.
Yeah.
And like you said, you go to school and all of a sudden you get a black roommate. What's going on here? This is happening pretty quick.
It's happening very fast.
You know, it's like, whoa, slow down.
Yeah.
Give me a chance to catch my breath.
Let's read a couple more paragraphs because it'll make this a little more complex, I think, as we go on. So if we can have somebody pick up with the paragraph and later hiding in the latrine.
Later, hiding in the latrine from the black boys, I take a look at my own self in the mirror and wonder how it was possible that anybody could manage such an enormous thing as being what he was. There'd be my face in the mirror, dark and hard, with big, high cheekbones like the cheek underneath them had been hacked out with a hatchet, eyes all black and hard and mean-looking, just like Papa's eyes, or the eyes of all those tough, mean-looking Indians you see on TV. And I'd think, that ain't me. That ain't my face. It wasn't even me when I was trying to be that face. I wasn't even really me then. I was just being the way I looked, the way people wanted. It don't seem like I ever been me. How can McMurphy be what he is? I was seeing him different than when he first came in. I was seeing more to him than just big hands and red sideburns and a broken-nosed grin. I'd see him do things that didn't fit with his face or hands. Things like painting a picture at OT with real paints on a blank paper with no lines or numbers anywhere on it to tell him where to paint. Or like writing letters to somebody in a beautiful flowing hand. How could a man who looked like him paint pictures or write letters to people or be upset and worried like I saw him once when he got a letter back? These were the kind of things you expected from Billy Bibbit or Harding. Harding had hands that looked like they should have done paintings, though they never did. Harding trapped his hands and forced them to work sawing planks for doghouses. McMurphy wasn't like that. He hadn't let what he looked like run his life one way or the other any more than he'd let the combine mill him into fitting where they wanted him to fit.
Okay. That's an interesting paragraph.
You did?
Right. Okay. And so this is Kesey making this portrait of McMurphy more complex. And to give Kesey credit as a novelist, what we're seeing, and again, we're literally right in the middle. This is page 140 in my edition. There are 281 pages. So we are smack dab in the middle of the novel, right as Chief Bromden is coming to this awareness of what it is about McMurphy that has got him so entranced. This is a man who is what he is, but more complex, that there is, to put it simply, there's a sensitive side to him. There's this sensitivity that he gets a letter back. He obviously has friends. He has relationships. He has people that he's connected to. And this is what we're going to see in the second half of the novel, is we move from a McMurphy who is a gambler, who's taking advantage of people, who's fun-loving and so on, and increasingly is coming to understand what's going on in the mental hospital as a microcosm of the combine, of what's going on in the country, the military-industrial complex, to use that language. And these days, not just military, but I don't know what globalization, economic power, however you want to define that, whatever it is we see is kind of controlling our lives and out of our control. But McMurphy is increasingly going to be aware of this, and he's going to be having to make decisions about, does he save his own skin? To save his own skin, he learns that he has to play by the rules. Because Big Nurse has complete power.
The thing that struck me is that he is portrayed as an artist, as a painter.
Yes, exactly.
Where did that part of him come out?
Yes.
You know, he's a very complex, integrated person can write poetry and is affected by a letter from someone.
Exactly.
And paints a picture of beauty that transcends the ordinary.
Yeah. He writes letters to somebody in a beautiful, flowing hand. If we're thinking gender, of course, this is a very feminine. Yeah. Okay. So there is this other aspect to McMurphy as well. And so, let's see. Next paragraph. Is somebody with K? keep us going here. But, you know, next couple of paragraphs would be great. Bottom of page 140.
I was seeing lots of things different. I figured the fog machine had broke down in the walls when they turned it up too high for that meeting on Friday. So now they weren't able to circulate fog and gas and foul up the way things looked. For the first time in years, I was seeing people with none of that black outline they used to have. And one night I was even able to see out the windows. Like I explained, most nights before they ran me to bed, they gave me this pill, knocked me out and kept me out. Or if something went haywire with a dose and I woke up, my eyes were all crusted over and the dorm was full of smoke, wires in the walls loaded to the limit, twisting and sparking death and hate in the air. All too much for me to take, so I'd ram my head under the pillow and try to get back to sleep. Every time I peeked back out there, it would be smell of burning hair and a sound like side meat on a hot grill.
Yeah. So fog, this image of fog, this metaphor of fog, I mean, to me, again, there's something very powerful about these paragraphs, which are obviously, we don't take them literally. The halls are not literally filled up with fog. The dorm is not literally filled up with smoke, wires in the wall. Well, maybe there are wires in the wall. but twisting and sparking death and hate in the air. Right? To me, actually, what you're getting in Chief Bromden is somebody who is, in fact, sensitive to what is, in fact, going on.
This wasn't a reference to the cook and their brains?
Oh, it probably is also that. I mean, so there is, in that sense, there is a literalness to it.
Yeah.
There probably is. I mean, electroshock therapy.
I wonder
so,
if they did it at night or something.
Yeah, yeah. And we also learned that Chief Bromden had himself undergone, you know, shock therapy many, many times.
And that was the fog.
Yes, yes, yes. So there is that, there is a literal quality to that. But I think it's also the sense of somebody who is so sensitive to what's going on that it's impossible to live with that kind of awareness. That's my sense of it. Sparking death and hate in the air. I mean, that's in fact what was happening in the country. And most of us, most of the time, are, and you know, we don't have to put this in past tense, I'm always wanting to juxtapose it with where we are today as well. You know, if we were truly sensitive to what's going on right now in the world, whether you think of climate change or the economic and so on and so forth, how would we possibly be able to stand it? Right? And so Chief Bromden is somebody who, this hospital becomes a metaphor for just that, that rage, that energy that is wanting to erupt somehow, wanting to be channeled, ideally in positive ways, you know, wanting to claim a true self and a true identity, to take it back to civil rights and take it back to feminism. Those things were both starting to surface. People who are saying, you know, my life is too constricted, I want more. So that's what we're getting. And a little bit further, if somebody would pick up at this one night.
But this one night, a few nights after the big meeting, I woke up and the dorm was clean and silent, except for the soft breathing of the men and the stuff rattling around loose under the brittle ribs of the two old vegetables. It was dead quiet. A window was up, and the air in the dorm was clear and had a taste to it that made me feel kind of giddy and drunk, gave me the sudden yen to get up out of bed and do something. I slid from between the sheets and walked barefoot across the cold tile between the beds. I felt the tile with my feet and wondered how many times, how many thousand times, had I run a mop over the same tile floor and never felt it at all. That mopping seemed like a dream to me, like I couldn't exactly believe all those years of it had really happened. Only that cold linoleum under my feet was real right then. Only that moment. Keep going?
Keep going. Yeah, a couple more.
I walked among the guys heaped in long white rows like snowbanks, careful not to bump into somebody, till I came to the wall with the windows. I walked down the windows to one where the shade popped softly in and out with the breeze, and I pressed my forehead up against the mesh. The wire was cold and sharp, and I rolled my head against it from side to side to feel it with my cheeks, and I smelled the breeze. It's fall coming, I thought. I can smell that sour molasses smell of silage clanging the air like a bell. Smell somebody's been burning oak leaves, left them to smolder overnight because they're too green. It's fall coming. I kept thinking, fall coming. Just like that was the strangest thing ever happened. Fall. Right outside here, it was spring a while back, and it was summer. Now it's fall. That sure curious idea. I realized I still had my eyes shut. I'd shut them when I put my face to the screen, like I was scared to look outside. Now I had to open them. I looked out the window and saw for the first time how the hospital was out in the country. The moon was low in the sky over the pasture land. The face of it was scarred and scuffed where it had just torn up out of the snarled scrub oak and the drone trees on the horizon. Stars up close to the moon were pale. They got brighter and braver the farther they got out of the circle ruled by the giant moon. It called to mind how I noticed the exact same thing when I was off on a hunt with Papa and the uncles, and I lay rolled in blankets Grandma had woven, lying off a piece from where the men hunkered around the fire as they bounced a quart jar of cactus liquor in a silent circle. I watched that big Oregon prairie moon above me put all the stars around it to shame. I kept awake watching to see if the moon ever got dimmer or if the stars got brighter till the dew commenced to drift onto my cheeks and I had to pull a blanket over my head.
Okay, we'll stop there. So can you feel just the shift in the language? I mean, we're in lyrical language now. We're in natural language. There is this feeling of waking up out of a fog, out of, and again, that fog, dream, whatever metaphor you want to use for the state of mind that Chief Bromden had been in for so long. He is waking up to himself, finally, and that awareness of his surroundings and of the countryside. Of course, it's that natural imagery that works so strongly. Yes, his context, his own family context, memories, the connecting back to something positive, something healthy, something life-giving. And I love that phrase that, you know, he had his eyes shut, I was scared to look outside, now I had to open them. It's an interesting phrase, now I had to open them. I mean, it's as if, yeah, he has a choice to make. He's conscious of a choice. And the opening of his eyes functions literally and figuratively, clearly. And he's now literally seeing out the window and seeing the natural world and connecting to it. The moon was low in the sky. The face of it was scarred and scuffed, or it just torn out of the snarless. Scarred and scuffed, what does that remind us of in this novel?
McMurphy's hands.
Exactly, McMurphy's hands, yeah. So there's this wonderful little connection between that passage very early on as the chief is shaking with Murphy's hands and that moonlight. And so this moonlight shining through the window, this natural force, yeah. You know, and again, to translate this into our context, Holden created 50 years ago, this fantastic dream that somebody had, that I've become more and more aware of this time, of just how crazy an idea it was, given the condition of this place when the Lutheran Church took it over. But you can also imagine those first few people coming up here and looking around, and on the one hand seeing dilapidated buildings and damage and destruction, but also looking around at these mountains and Railroad Creek and thinking, what we could do with it. I mean, the feeling of these mountains, of that natural landscape. Right? Surely so many of us are here. Again, do we not at times feel that we're coming here and we wake up? We wake up again. We come out of the fog. We come out of whatever it is that's, you know, working in our ordinary lives. And we come back to something foundational.
But we first have to hide before we can come out.
Apparently.
That's kind of what we do, you know. We come here to refresh and see the moon and the,
yes,
and the clouds,
yes,
and the sky. And then once we get that vision again,
yes,
then the,
yeah,
military industrial complex isn't quite as severe.
Yes.
The crisis in Greece. Or
that's the hope, at
the
least.
The presidential election, you know. It's
right.
Not quite as overwhelming.
Yes. Yes, that's the hope.
Yeah,
and
perspective.
Yes. I see we're out of time. We will continue tomorrow at, I think, 6:15 or 6:30. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.